Getting better at that.
At clapping?
Yeah.
Or counting?
Clapping.
Oh.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Richard Wally.
And you are Cassidy Robinson.
And we are both in Portland, Oregon.
We happen to be there, yes.
Recording live from Jabber Studios, the PDX location.
Yeah, that's a good way to say that, I suppose. Do you really mean on my apartment floor? Is that what you mean? Yeah, okay.
It's comfortable.
It is. Well, you have a nice pillow.
Uh-huh.
And I get to sit on the ground like some fucking homeless person.
I require certain things for podcasting.
I know, you're a princess. It's cool.
Yes.
Are you going to sing me some Frozen songs?
I have been all day. Okay, so somehow you're like flipping through Facebook and you start complaining like, Frozen, I'm so sick of this movie. And I go, I know, like that song, Let It Go, right? And I start singing it and you're like, I've never heard that song before.
No, I know. I have a firewall for songs that I don't like, just don't, aren't going to do it for me. And I don't like. Uh-huh. It's just like automatic firewall. Songs don't really get stuck in my head very easily. It's quite wonderful. I think other people should have it.
My thing was, I don't understand where you get off complaining about the Frozen phenomenon without knowing the song.
Memes are enough. I just need to see the pictures enough and enough people telling me how great princesses are and how snowmen and all that bullcrap is great. I don't need that anymore. I get that enough. Like, it's not even that bad as it was like a couple months ago. But like now, even if I see 120 down in my list on Facebook, I'm like, yeah, throwing a fit.
You're over it.
I'm done.
And you have never had to like deal with the barrage of Let It Go playing in pretty much every bank and every gas station and every grocery store and 20 different people posting their videos of their kids singing it.
No, because I mean, most people, they'll go into a grocery store or these bank places and they like will automatically have to listen to the song.
Mm-hmm.
I literally choose not to.
It's just white noise to you.
Yeah. And then basically like somebody will point it out and I'll listen for a second and be like, okay, why do you want me to listen to this? And they're like, oh, it's annoying. I'm like, well, why would you want me to listen to that then?
It's like bringing you something really bad you have to smell. It's like, oh, you have to smell this. It's awful.
Yes. But I don't have to do that with music.
Yeah. Well, so yes, I've been here. I've been staying with you for the past week.
Yeah, it's been horrible, right?
A little. Actually, today it's exactly a week.
Yes.
You picked me up last Monday. We didn't have an official episode.
No, we had
last week.
We had a special. What meshal? I don't know what that is.
A special DVD commentary.
Yeah, that's what we had
for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So if listeners haven't checked that out, they should.
I tried to make it adjective-y and like circusy, but it just kept coming out as special, but not.
Mm-hmm. You had a mini seizure.
Yeah,
but it's been fun here hanging out with you in Portland and going to see things and meeting your friends and kind of seeing what your world's all about.
What's
you
your
always
favorite?
Check in.
What's your favorite?
What's my favorite?
Yeah, what's your favorite of Portland so far?
My favorite Portland? My favorite Portland thing?
Yeah.
I think, you know, as dumb as this sounds, I just really like the layout and the look of the city.
Hmm.
Like, I like walking around. I like driving through when we go to downtown, like, all through all these foresty tree areas. And then we pop into another little pocket of city. And then we go through some more forest, and then we find another pocket of city. Like, I just really like the magicalness of this area. But we've done fun things. We went to the beach yesterday, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Even though my shins and my feet are completely sunburnt, because I thought that I would only need sunscreen from the waist up for some reason.
Yeah, you planned poorly.
I did wrong. But we also went and saw Clueless at the Hollywood Theater.
That's what I was going to say. So that wasn't your favorite, that I literally sacrificed seeing a horror movie so you could watch Clueless on the big screen?
Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's right. You better be thanking me on air.
I
want it recorded.
And it was a blast, and it was a lot of fun. And it's a great theater. If anyone's in Portland and they want to check out a really cool rep house, go to the Hollywood Theater. It's an old-style 1930s.
20s. Yeah, 20s, 30s. Like
theater with a gigantic screen, and they really do it up, and it's a lot of fun. And no, I've just been sort of enjoying the whole thing.
Yeah. Getting the Portland experience.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this time, unlike last time, when you were in a different apartment, I had to sleep on the floor. Now I have my own room, which has been nice.
Yeah, sleeping on the floor, not as fun, right?
Usually not, no. I mean, we already went I'm a princess.
Yeah.
So.
I have to serve him lemons and ice in his water. And
yeah.
Also, he can't have sugar in anything. And it's actually kind of ruined your trip because we have just been eating loads and loads of
ice cream
in front of you.
I'm on a... I'm not calling it a diet. I'm calling it an experiment.
Oh.
My experiment is to see if I can go without sugar for the summer. Although I had to cheat. I had to cheat because everywhere we go, you kept getting ice cream. And it was just making me, like, insane. So finally, I was like, fine, I'm going to have ice cream today. But
I'm glad my experiment finally worked.
What, ruin me?
How long
to
does it take me to break his,
my sugar sobriety?
His experiment? Yes.
Do you just go to AA meetings and go, hey, I brought shooters for everyone?
Yeah, I do. That's how I roll.
All right, let's get into the movie news. We're kind of backed up here because we missed a week, and there's a lot of stuff we're sifting through, so if you do follow us on Facebook, there's some stories there that we're not going to be talking about here. But I guess let's start with one of the bigger news stories, which is this whole Justice League Warner Brothers lineup. They've announced that their future schedule, they're kind of doing the Marvel model now, where they're going to have, you know, movies planned 20 years in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the schedule as they have it so far. So we have Batman versus Superman coming out in 2016, which actually got pushed because that was supposed to come out next year.
Yeah, and that's actually pretty great because we don't have to have the Batman...
The Blitz of 2015.
Yeah, and we don't have to have that going up against Avengers. Like, I mean, that was just stupid anyways. Like, what were they thinking?
Yeah. I wanted it to be kind of like the 50 Cent versus Kanye West CD release battle, but... didn't happen quite like that. Also in 2016, we're having a Shazam movie, which is kind of bizarre. They're really kind of throwing it out there with that. Maybe they're thinking that's going to be, like, their Thor.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's kind of a strange, like, underrated character. And also, I mean, he's always cool in the comics because... So, one thing that they never go into for some reason or don't like going into with DC is Superman actually has... two vulnerabilities. It's not just this little green rock. He's also vulnerable to magic. And for some reason, they almost never exploit that very much.
Yeah.
And Shazam is actually, all of his strength and everything about him is based on, like, a magic thing. And so he can go toe-to-toe with Superman and beat the crap out of him because he's magically strong Superman.
We'll see how they roll that into the gritty Man of Steel universe.
Yeah, I have no idea. Also, that's the other thing, thinking about that, I don't know what they're going to do with that character. Are they gonna go, because if they go at it full and he has his weird, like, I mean, there's like gods and stuff that he like Greek gods and stuff like that that he comes from.
Battle.
Well, I mean, Wonder Woman is like that too, so I mean there's, but we also, I mean, on the agenda, they also decided to put Sandman
on Christmas of 2016. So three movies next year, or the year after next.
Yeah.
And this isn't Neil Gaiman Sandman.
Yeah, I'm gonna...
You think it is?
They're not... Well, I know they're not developing, like, the 1940s character with the gas mask and the gun. Like, no, this is the one... I'm assuming this is the one that they've been developing with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope that that's watchable. And then 2017, we're having the big Justice League movie.
Mm.
God, that feels like so far away. I don't even know why we're talking about this. And then after Justice League, even though apparently her character is being introduced in Batman versus Superman, we have the Wonder Woman movie. Most iconic female superhero character of all time is getting a movie after Shazam.
Right. Sounds about like the DC model. No, and then after that even, Flash and Green Lantern team up.
Mm-hmm, on Christmas 2017.
Yeah.
That actually, of all of these, sounds like the most fun.
Right.
Like, I want that movie instead of almost all of these. But we have, they'll have to introduce Flash and Green Lantern again in the Justice League movie. So we'll see what those characters
are. Or maybe Batman versus Superman or Shazam or the God Sandman movie. I don't know, whatever. I have no idea what they're planning. But then, because we're not done, they're also doing Man of Steel 2.
In 2018.
Yeah.
Which, that feels like a million years away. By then, what's his face? The guy who's playing Superman right now.
Well, by then, the world will
Henry Cavill, he's going to be like 80 years old.
Right.
Well, so there's that.
And then the side little bit of information that came trickling out with that, now that they've adopted the Marvel model, is that they're getting Jason Momoa to mm-hmm. probably play Aquaman.
And he's supposed to have an appearance in Batman vs. Superman, right?
Apparently.
So Jason Momoa, in case people don't know, he's a Game of Thrones actor. He was also played Conan in the reboot of that. He was also in Bullet in the Head, the Stallone throwaway programmer.
I mean, he's fairly charismatic and
he's
like
big.
Honestly, he's big. He's been at least kind of entertaining, even when he's been in a shitty movie. Like yeah. He's been okay, but
I guess what's interesting about this is that people generally think of Aquaman as this kind of like blonde, blue-eyed, Aryan-looking seaman.
Yeah.
And now we're having this very ethnic actor play him.
Well, I'm going to assume from his last name that he's some sort of Pacific Islander, Filipino,
yeah,
or something.
I think so.
Of that,
yeah, yeah.
Of that ilk.
And he, you know, very. Tall, dark, and big-shouldered, barrel-chested kind of guy. And he's, you know, generally kind of looked at sort of a meathead. So it'll be, I don't know, I wonder what kind of take they're going to use, take the character, if he's going to be sort of the fisherman with the hook hand.
He's just going to be from Hawaii.
And that's his thing. He just has a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
Has a pet goldfish that he has with him all the time in, like, a baggie.
Hey, what's up, dudes? You guys want to go surfing?
All right, what's the next piece of news we have here?
The good part of news is Mr. Tom Hiddleston will be playing country icon Hank Williams.
And we'll sing his own music as well.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. No, this is... I actually saw an older picture of Hank Williams, and he was a lot skinnier, and he wasn't that, like, haggard, like, what I know of Hank Williams Sr.
Yeah.
He's not that beardy fat guy. but he looks... I mean, you can kind of see, even in this picture, he... kind of actually it works a lot, and it'll be interesting. I mean, I was into the whole
Only Lovers Left Alive.
Well, Only Lovers Left Alive music thing, and then also the whole Johnny Cash, Joaquin Phoenix
jam.
So, yeah. I mean, even if it's that kind of kitschy and kind of whatever, I'll probably enjoy it.
Yeah, I like Tom Hiddleston a lot, and I think that of all of the things to come out of the Marvel superhero kind of thing, if anything, that gave us Tom Hiddleston. And he's a great actor, and he's very versatile, mm-hmm. and you know, he's an English kind of actor's actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he could bring a lot to this. And it's always interesting to see like actors do their own singing, and we'll see what that ends up being, if he can pull it off. It'd be funny if he couldn't do that at all. Like, he looks the part.
Yeah.
The movie's even pretty good. but he doesn't sound anything like Hank Williams.
That's true. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. I personally, we were looking up, the director isn't really a director.
He's mostly just producing credits at this point. Yeah.
And so it's sort of like, okay, whatever. So yeah. I don't know really what we're going to be looking at other than Tom Hiddleston being a country dude.
More than anything, the movie I could kind of take or leave. I don't need a Hank Williams biopic, but I'm interested to see Tom Hiddleston keep doing different things.
Right.
And showing the world all he can do. Because he's the real deal.
Yeah, that's how I feel about Anna Kendrick in this this next film.
Anna Kendrick is to voice DreamWorks animated Trolls movie. Now, this isn't a sequel to the horror film Troll.
No.
Even though you'd probably
appreciate that. I would appreciate, you know. Yeah. Even a sequel Troll 3, to Troll 2.
Because we need that to be a trilogy, really.
Yeah, like, so we get the full...
Get the whole thing.
Because Troll 1 and Troll 2 had so much, like, overlap. And, like, really, it gets really deep into the mythology.
Yeah. I mean, they're so different from each other that maybe Troll 3 could really wrap it up.
Right.
Tie them together.
Well, this might be the third tie-in to the film still. But we're talking about the pointy-haired, colorful... Trolls. We're not talking like I had to do like the hand action, like a point with my hair. Yeah, you had kind to like thing.
Insinuate a cone head kind of shape.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are the troll toys from the 90s novelty toys. There was a troll character in Toy Story.
Oh, maybe that's where they were like, man, we gotta get on that Toy Story money.
I'm sure. And Anna Kendrick, you know, she's lovely, she's effervescent. Sure. I don't know if I really need a Trolls movie, but it's happening.
More we wanted to talk about Trolls, I think. Like,
yeah.
Like, as a, like, little toy with oftentimes with a gem in their belly.
Yeah, those are the treasure trolls.
Yeah.
I was all about the treasure trolls.
I bet you were.
Actually, I was, if we really want to get into it, I was really into Battle Trolls.
Oh, yeah, no.
Because that's where it was at.
Well, what's funny is I asked for Battle Trolls one Christmas. And my mom was like, Trolls? Are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I want Battle Trolls. And she was like, okay. Well, she ended up buying me a bunch of the trolls with the gems in their belly. But, and so I was a little disappointed. I'm not going to lie. But what I did get out of it was I always had, like, fodder for, like, battles and stuff like that. So, and their hair is kind of fun to play with. You just kind of, like, wisp it on your face and then you throw it at the wall.
Brush it, put hair pretties in.
Yeah, put hair pretties, the whole thing. Yeah.
All right. And our last news item here. We roll through these a lot faster than we're in the same room.
Yeah.
This is the big news. You want to go ahead with this?
Sure. So, so for the next 8 and 9 of Star Wars, the episodes. Wow, I said that all backwards.
Yeah, you're saying it like Yoda.
Yeah. Anyways, so for episodes 8 and 9, 7 is being done by J.J. Abrams, but what they decided to do is Rian Johnson from Looper and Brick and Brothers Bloom will be coming in to direct the next two films, 8 and 9.
And write them,
yes, that's right.
Yeah. This is definitely kind of a bold choice. Looper had a wide release, but he's kind of, I would say, considered kind of a niche director.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has a voice. He definitely has a style.
Yeah.
That's kind of early cultivated style, and he has a lot of potential, kind of like Duncan Jones in that way. He's not quite... to the point where he's a known name, but he could very well be something.
Well, I think he's a known name at, like, kind of like people to watch kind of name.
Yeah.
But we don't have enough of a film body to say a lot about him. It's kind of, I mean, it's even kind of like Gareth Edwards, who just did the Godzilla movie and things like that. Like it's, he's sort of a, I personally am a big fan of, especially Brick and Looper. I thought Looper was a lot of fun.
I believe it was on both of our top tens that year.
It should have been. I'm cautiously like, oh, that's interesting and kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So far, I think that's what I've mostly got out of the Star Wars news is they're actually kind of looking at interesting and kind of
fresh talent, yeah,
including in the acting and stuff. And with J.J. Abrams, it's interesting that he's directing the first one and then passing it off the baton on the second two,
yeah,
because it's almost sort of like reminiscent of the old ones in a weird way,
yeah.
Yeah, and J.J. Abrams was almost like, yeah, he's gonna do Star Wars, you know. But I thought it was interesting because he definitely has a take and it's something big for him. So I'm more or less, I can get behind this. I'm like, okay, cool. Let's see what he does with them.
Yeah. I'm kind of on the fence with this news, not because I think he's going to be bad for Star Wars. I think, you know, the more talent they get on board with this, the better these movies could potentially be. My issue is I kind of think he's selling himself short.
Mm-hmm.
I think he could be, because as soon as he does these Star Wars movies, he's officially the Star Wars guy.
Sure.
And I'm afraid that he's limiting his options by doing this, and he's going to get stuck into the blockbuster cycle.
And then right after.
And just become kind of a Jerry Bruckheimer type.
So right after this, he's going to instantly make Howard the Duck?
That I would be into, actually. No, I'm afraid he's just going to kind of become, you know, more or less just kind of a big studio hack. And I would really like to see him keep cultivating this interesting voice he has rather than color inside the Star Wars lines.
Well, and what if he does it interesting inside the Star Wars lines?
Well, I mean, optimally, that would be the best thing, but, you know, I don't know. This whole series is just this big wait and see.
It is.
And it's almost like making me like nervous. Like I can't, like, I just need these movies to come out. Not because I'm so excited to see them, because I just need to like,
you want to know
what they are.
What is happening exactly? Right. I'm on that more positive side of the fence with them so far. I just think everything sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And it's not in George Lucas's hands for the, honestly, I feel that. I'm just like, yeah, it's not in his hands. Let's see what it is. Mm-hmm. Honestly, because you're like, oh, expectations are so high. I actually think expectations are diffused because we already had the prequels, which weren't well received.
Yeah.
And so I think it's kind of like, let's just make some good, fun films. And
yeah.
So that's what I'm actually hoping for. And that's where I'm, so far, I see the trajectory for. But it's, again, all bullshit in my head.
Okay.
And coming out my mouth now.
And I think we've all kind of been in that same sort of logical cycle.
Yeah.
Since we heard about these prequels. So yeah, we'll definitely have to wait and see for those. Okay, we're gonna move on to the pet topic, and this is something we were kind of jostling back and forth about the other day in a regular talking in face to face without a microphone mode.
Okay.
You had this kind of interesting theory that I kind of wanted to go into a little bit more. You had this theory that people are frustrated with modern day blockbusters or modern day fun action adventure films because they remember, we're still in this time period where they remember going to movies and seeing these kind of tropes laid out for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And now that they're kind of cemented and they're seeing the tropes over and over again, they feel like they're not getting what they're supposed to be getting out of it, even though they're getting the same thing. Is that more or less how you tried to word that? Would you say I'm in the ballpark of what you were saying?
You're in the ballpark. Basically, I think that in film, we're kind of coming to a period of time where there aren't as many new things. But the only reason they were new things is because film was such a new medium in general.
Yeah.
Also, technology inhibited a lot of types of storytelling. So I do think we're kind of coming to this kind of like almost crescendo of it being like the new and lively kind of medium. And basically what I think people are like, well, we've seen that. Well, we've seen that. Well, that's not the point anymore that you've seen it. It's whether it's good or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's more, I mean, I'm sure the first time a few books came out, it was like, holy shit, did you read that Odyssey? Wow. You know, well, I mean, you know.
It's exactly how they spoke in ancient Greece.
Yeah, exactly. Bro, the Iliad, fuck.
Homer's the boss.
Blew my mind. Yeah. But what I'm saying is it's just become new, and we're kind of coming onto this phenomenon, I think, is why the sequel thing is happening. That's what sparked the conversation.
Yeah.
Is I because you're like, oh, they're always remaking and sequelizing things. Well, I think actually there was a big period of sequels and
remakes
are really just filling in for the place of those blatant ripoffs.
Yeah.
They're really just saying, oh, look, name recognition. This is a blatant ripoff, really, but we're just putting it out there. And I'm not for these, of course, but what I'm saying is I think kind of the, I think we're just coming to a crux in film where it's like, okay, where now? Where are we going to go now? I actually think there has to become almost like a new movement in film. We're at a crossroads in film, and that's what I think partially is happening, especially with the new boom in technology where you can make blue people jumping around on a planet doing whatever the stuff, having sex with braids and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What's funny is if you had said that sentence 17 years ago, you'd sound like you just need to be locked away.
Yeah.
But that is a movie that a lot of people went and saw.
You mean the majority of people went and saw.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with you in the sense that film is relatively speaking, and we don't tend to think of this, but relatively speaking in the world of the arts, if you're talking about theater, painting and sculpture, music, film is one of the newest mediums. And we're still developing film language as technology keeps changing.
Well, we're still, I mean, I...
And maybe what the problem is that right now we're in this awkward phase where we still think of film in terms of old film language with all of these new technologies. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a, you know, shoving a square peg into a round hole sort of phenomenon.
Well, I mean, I was also thinking of somebody like Edgar Wright. I really like Edgar Wright. I think he's a great filmmaker. But if you look at his films, I mean, especially the Coronetto trilogy, mm-hmm. I mean, those films are like synthesizing other films.
Yeah.
And it's almost films about film genre.
Mm-hmm.
It's not almost, they are films about film genre. I think we're in a weird reflective state, and I think it's just, it's everything, it's a lot of things combined. Film is coming to a crossroads. Also with internet, that's really changing things because your ability to receive films and stuff like that, we're not seeing them on the big screens all the time, we're not. And so there's a lot of things that are influencing how we see films. I mean, I'm almost like, okay, should we really be looking at it as like moving pictures? Like, should we? And because TV is kind of similar, but it's kind of a different format. But are they really subgenres of the same thing? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not trying to open up a new can of worms, but what I'm saying is we're really coming to a crux where it's like, well, what, you know, what is this supposed to be still? Because,
yeah.
I mean, in film, we got into The Wizard of Oz specifically. When you saw The Wizard of Oz the first time, it blew your fucking mind because it was a book moving in front of you. It was something big and crazy and new. But that's really, I mean, but all of the ideas and everything that's been in movies, a lot of it has come from books and other storytelling before that. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but what I'm saying is that people wanting this kind of almost like frustration with wanting something new, almost, I'm actually thinking it's coming to a period where we shouldn't be looking for something new as we should be looking for what's good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know. I tend to agree with you on most points. Mm-hmm. I do think that film in and of itself has a unique quality that can't be replicated mm-hmm. in other mediums. And I think a large part of the reason why people think, like, you know, we're in the age of television and that film is a dying medium is largely because people aren't living up to the potential that film can really be. You know, we see very few films that we kind of haven't already seen before in some way or another, either in tropes or in direct sequels and remakes and these kinds of things, which has a lot more to do with branding than it does with storytelling.
Yeah.
And that's why when I see a film like Upstream Color, which we talked about a little bit, and I'm seeing new film language being developed before my very eyes, I get really excited. Because whether or not that movie uses those new languages the best way, it shows potential that there's still more we can be doing.
Well, it's a cinematic movie. We've talked a little bit about how excited I've been with entries like... Like, I think Under the Skin is very cinematic movie.
Yeah.
And it uses some very... I mean, it's not necessarily going big budget. It's actually going opposite. But it's creating these spaces within the film realm to basically show you something that you couldn't see in another format.
Yeah.
And so that's where, I mean, with the TV influence... You know, I do think that they are like sisters of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that for a long time, it was film that was influencing television. But yeah. Right now, it's kind of coming to the first time television has been influencing film.
Yeah.
And why I think that's, I think that's interesting because I think that will continue to be that way. Those people blend in between both mediums. It's just how they work together
mm-hmm.
and they lend to each other. But I think what really separates them is the length and how they're shown.
Yeah.
Like really that's what, and where they're meant to be shown. We're both staunch supporters that cinema should be seen in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's just pure size. And so you're basically, you're playing to that kind of, and I'm not talking about explosions, you know, because with like Under the Skin, for example, it wasn't about big explosions. It was about that absence of things.
Yeah.
And it was about being in that public space and experiencing that giantness.
Yeah. And watching the strange story unfold and not knowing where it's going to go.
I actually think it's less that, I think that TV is becoming more cinematic and it becoming better in that sense. Then I think that that movies are getting worse.
Yeah.
So, there's my two cents.
agreed. I think more or less, yeah. What we're dancing around here, without actually saying, is the postmodern dilemma, which is everything that's been thought of has been thought of, and now it's just, you know, we're on this hamster wheel running in place.
Well, it's hard too because it's so apparent now because we do have an instant influx of history and of visuals and of film, you know, and in film specifically of film history, and we can get films at any time in several different forms, and you can buy it physically, you can buy it digitally, you can get it through streaming services, you can pull it off of the internet, you can steal it, you can, you know, and so it's hard not to, you know, as a creative person, when you're creating something, I think it's hard to escape your influences completely. And I don't think you can really.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into our reviews. And, just before we get started here, I'm going to say we're not doing the Netflix homework this week.
Yeah, we're not.
The, dog ate my homework.
Yeah, the dog, I watched it.
Dog named Richard.
Yeah, the dog named Richard ate his homework.
And I never really got a chance to watch it. I could have found a way to kind of slip it in the cracks between when we were doing stuff, but it would have, you know, put a hamper on some of the activities.
Having fun.
Yeah. So we're going to save that review for next week, but we have two reviews backed up. We'll start here with 22 Jump Street, and then after we'll review the new film, The Rover. But let's go ahead and get into 22 Jump Street, and I'll let you set that up.
Okay. So, obviously, this is a sequel to 21 Jump Street, but...
coming off of our...
yeah, coming off
discussion of adaptations and sequels.
Yeah, that's an adaptation of a TV show from the 80s.
Yeah.
So, it's sort of funny. But what they do right... so this film based, so what they did right in the first film, it was very meta. It was very,
self-referential,
but it also played directly to the modern generation.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to kind of just synthesize and be generalists and there's cliques and whatever.
And hit X, Y, and Z genre tropes and.
They played to our generation. What is kind of more going on around the zeitgeist, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
In the sequel, I think they continue and it's still just strong, funny material. They just kind of, they develop it in interest. They just basically do what they did in the first one, just as smart. Mm-hmm. What the film basically is about is they decided that high school was too ridiculous and that these people look too old. And so they sent them to college.
Yeah.
And to do the same kind of undercover work.
Yeah, looking for some new drug called Wi-Fi.
Yeah. They kind of almost make it like, they almost make it like Scooby-Doo in a lot of ways because it's like, oh, it's kind of almost referencing TV again.
Uh-huh.
And we're doing it like this is the next, like,
episode
kind of slash sequel. So it gets meta as hell.
Yeah, because not only is it meta about the idea that they're doing an adaptation of a show, but it's also a lot of meta jokes about sequelitis in general. They make a lot of jokes. Ice Cube and Nick Offerman, who plays the head of the department or whatever, makes all these jokes about this is exactly the same as what you're going to be doing last time.
Yeah.
People don't want different. So here we are. You're going to do the same thing again. And of course, they're talking to the audience and we're all in on the joke. And this is directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who also did the Lego movie most recently. Earlier this year, they also were involved they wrote the first one, but they did Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and originally came together on the very referential MTV cartoon Clone High. And so this has been their shtick since the beginning. And I'd say what they're really good at is... and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, they're really, really good at almost this kind of underhand, subversive commentary on the state of modern commercial movie making while still making commercial movies.
Well, no, they're undoubtedly... I think the first one was a lot of fun. I haven't really revisited it, but it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it. Like,
I remember being so surprised by that movie.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But the second one, I think, follows suit, and in a fun and good way. It's funny.
It builds upon the things that I think we came to like in the first one, specifically the unlikely chemistry between Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum.
Yeah.
They just work so well together, and that, you know, Jonah Hill's kind of the fast-talking, vetted comedian type, and Channing Tatum's sort of the straight man, but he has this kind of lovable, dopey quality, and that pairing is kind of gold.
It kind of works, yeah.
It really works.
Okay, it doesn't kind of.
They can sell about any scene they're in.
Right.
And, Ice Cube gets a lot more to do in this movie, and he's a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, he's funny as hell.
There's about three scenes specifically involving Ice Cube and Jonah Hill that are just, they're going to, like, split your side laughing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Specifically one scene where Channing Tatum figures something out.
Oh, right.
After the audience has already known, like, half the movie.
that was pretty funny.
I haven't heard a theater, like, fully roar in laughter together like that, and me kind of be along with the ride. There is one weird hang up with this movie.
Okay.
And I don't know how to feel about it because Phil Lord and Chris Miller are so self-referential that I have to think that they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of homoerotic tension and jokes about that in the movie.
Oh yeah, I thought that was hilarious.
Specifically, I mean, not only between
breaking through the ceiling.
We've been joking about that, where they'd make this motion and it looks like fisting.
yeah.
But yeah, Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. I mean, basically, if you follow the line of this plot, it's almost like a romantic comedy. Because they're like this couple who are having troubles, and then they find other groups. And
well, I think it is, but it's also kind of almost commenting on that buddy cop kind of format.
Yeah, that this is sort of a thing, that there's almost a weird sort of sexual tension in those movies.
Well, and then then there's another character, this football player that they introduce, because he gets into the football team, and Channing Tatum's character is figuring himself out, and so there's this really subversive thing going on about them working out specifically, yeah, that I think is really, it's like that old Hollywood, they're totally doing it thing without actually showing them doing it or saying they're doing it. I think it's literally inferring that, yeah, that's what they're really doing here.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely, yeah, they're playing around with the sort of the macho, sexual tension there with those characters. And it runs all the way through. It's a reoccurring joke. And in the towards the end of the movie, there's even a scene where Channing Tatum comes unglued on this mob heavy,
yeah,
for using the three-letter F word.
Okay.
And you know, goes on about like that's homophobia and blah 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 blah, because he's taking a sexuality course.
That took me a second because I was like F U C minus the K. Wait, what?
and then so at that point they're addressing the elephant in the room.
Right.
From the whole movie. And my wonder is this a comment on the total integration of homosexuality in a way that now we can reference it like this in such a plain and open way? Mm. And the joke isn't necessarily ha 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 they're gay, but it's these are the genres that are addressing these things but never really talk about it.
Right.
Or is it coming all the way back around to homophobia again? Because if we can hide it and fold it up in a certain way and make it, you know, this kind of logical origami, can we get away with homophobic humor if it's clever?
I don't think so. I think we're kind of at the point, and I hope so, that we can just kind of joke about it.
Yeah.
And we don't have to get so heated about it anymore. That's how I took it. I mean, I guess some people can take it that way, but I thought it was pretty positive towards the whole thing. I mean, it wasn't like, it was never like, that's a bad thing. So I don't know. I don't think so. I think maybe if you wanted to take it like that, you could.
Well, okay. Specifically, so the scene where Channing Tatum berates this mob heavy, and he kind of goes in this whole diatribe. Is the joke there a guy like Channing Tatum is speaking progressively, and that's unlike his character type?
Okay.
Or is the joke political correctness sounds this silly?
Maybe both. I mean, honestly, maybe both, because maybe it does share a fair amount of both things.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's bad either. I think that that's kind of interesting, really, to say it's really both. It's really kind of ridiculous, but also kind of great, but also kind of, and honestly, it's, I keep using this damn word, but for this movie, it does make sense. It's within the zeitgeist of our culture right now. Really, really strongly and prominently. And so the best place I think to deal with it is in comedy, because you can diffuse the situation through the laugh but also say something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that film is kind of doing that. I think it's saying it's great that we live in this time, but there's also some silly things about it.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any ill, and see why I can't get behind the homophobia.
It never comes off as mean-spirited.
It's never mean-spirited at all. I don't think so. I think, and honestly, sometimes humor is a little mean-spirited, but I don't think it's specifically because it's like those gays over there. Like, it's not like that. I mean, and I think it's interesting too, because the other white elephant in the room that's never kind of addressed, and not in this film, but in general, we were talking about how, like, in our teenage years,
yeah,
like, that word was, you know, all of those words were used, like, more heavily than anything.
Like throwing candy out of a parade.
Yeah. And honestly, like, it's sort of weird where we are now versus then in such a short period of time. And so it's I actually think it's kind of gratifying just to see, oh, look at that flip already.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we were teenagers, like everything was gay. Everything was whatever, you know.
That chair's gay.
Yeah. That gay man's gay, yeah.
You know, I just wanted to pick at that a little bit. I don't know if I really have an answer for it. I'm going to give Phil Lord and Chris Miller the benefit of the doubt because I think they're so smart and they're so subversive that I can't imagine they would be thinking backwards in that regard.
The other thing is I just don't think it's supported in the film. Like, I have to look at the context of it and say, look at it. It's not... There's nothing mean-spirited about it, period.
Yeah. I will say...
Even if they are making fun of PC culture.
Okay. I will say about 21 Jump Street in general, that I don't think it's quite as tight as the first movie. There's some bookends on the movie that I feel are unnecessary. And I feel like it doesn't say as much or anything as interesting about the new generation that the first movie did. There's a little bit there, but I think more than anything, it's referencing itself rather than using this silly premise of a remake to examine modern culture. It's still funny as hell, though.
No,
the laugh per joke ratio is really high.
I actually think this is probably higher in this one. So on a funny level, I'd give it higher. I can say from a writing standpoint that you're probably right. There's some things that don't quite. But I do like that they play with the whole, like, almost TV kind of esque, like, oh, there's a red herring, and oh, there's...
Oh, that was funny.
Yeah, and oh, it's actually... Oh, we're going to play it up so it's exactly like the last one. But wait, it's not. Like, I think they do... I think there's some smart stuff. What... Like, the stuff at the end of the credits, specifically...
Yeah, stay for the credits. You want to stay for the credits.
Okay, that's not the bookend you're talking about.
No, I'm not talking about the fake poster stuff. I'm talking about... There's this big opening... scene that's it's funny because it's kind of shot like Michael Bay Bad Boys, like on purpose, but it's really unnecessary ultimately. And there's this, you know, the overarching plot of the movie, I think they're only peripherally interested in. They kind of give up on the plot by about the 2/3 mark.
Yeah, and I think I actually can't knock that much off of it because it was that scene was literally saying like, oh. They kept referencing and being like, oh, we've got a bigger budget. Mm-hmm. What can we do here? And then, like, later it comes back into the joke when they're, like, running shit over. And they're saying, and they're like, oh, we don't have enough for that in the budget. Don't hit that. And then they play that up. So I think everything about this is commenting. They're still going into the current zeitgeist, but then they're also commenting on the... But then they're also just commenting on sequels in general and our sequel culture in films.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know. I guess I'd have to see both of them again. Like, honestly, because this one, I had more fun with this one in a lot of ways.
I think this movie is hella funny.
Yeah.
Like, without a doubt. I think it, as a comedy, it scores very highly. I just, on a story level... it's a little messier.
And I can deal with that because...
Because you're there for the jokes anyway.
Well, yeah. Well, and I'm not a big comedy guy.
Mm-hmm.
I generally actually don't like many comedies. And this one, I don't know, it just works for me completely. And it's not even kind of like in my...
Wheelhouse.
In my wheelhouse. And I'm like, no, this is funny. This works.
All right. Well, now for something completely different... this week we saw the new Australian film by David Michaud, who also directed Animal Kingdom, which is kind of a lesser known but highly critically praised Australian film from a few years ago.
the film The Rover, which is co-written by Joel Edgerton, the actor. And it stars Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson. And basically the plot is, you know, we know very little about this Guy Pearce character when he first enters the frame. He's this kind of haggard-looking, world-weary, quiet, almost man-with-no-name type.
Oh, for sure.
And he walks into a bar, and then we notice a gigantic truck flip over behind him through the window, and they take his car as soon as their truck is out of commission. And then it becomes basically this road movie of Guy Pearce trying to get his car back from these gangsterish types.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to find them, he finds one of their brothers, played by Robert Pattinson, who's this kind of awkward,
slow,
kind of, yeah, slow, sort of doesn't, very unarticulate man.
Well, he's kind of well-meaning, though, and kind of, like, there's something very endearing about his
something
character.
Childlike.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's supposed to sort of lead him to his revenge to get his car back. And it all takes place sort of in the outback. And it all takes place in this really kind of ambiguous time period because it almost feels post-apocalyptic. There's things about it that you keep seeing that are just kind of incidental in the movie where you're like, wait a minute, is there a government?
This was like David Lynch's Road Warrior.
It has a Road Warrior vibe.
I think it has a David Lynch vibe, too, because I don't think any of... I think most of the characters, or at least... No, most of your characters are pretty stilted. Specifically, and I don't say that in a bad way, but I say that in a, like an almost a representational way.
Yeah.
And who I'm specifically talking about is your leads, Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson. You're almost getting into a very like, oh... They're more of a stand-in or archetype than they are like a real human being. And also, I mean, I think there's something pretty weird in, for as grounded and gritty and everything, there's something very surreal and just strange about the whole the whole film experience.
Yeah. It was really interesting. We went and saw this at the Cinetopia.
Cinetopia, sure.
Which is this big, fancy...
Muckety-muck.
Yeah, a bar theater where you can get drinks and the waitresses come to you before the movie starts and you have like a footrest and the whole thing.
It's leather.
Leather reclining chairs. Yeah, very nice. But also the sound was huge in this movie. And there's something about the sound design and the score of this movie that is constantly barraging you.
Oh, yeah.
With these very obstructional kind of sound mixes and weird noises. And you know, we just did our commentary for Texas Chainsaw and I talk a lot about that kind of stuff, and there's a lot of that going on here where it's not even necessarily a song or a melody. You're just hearing like a grinding noise kind of or
like
a pulsating beat,
an ambient kind of noise.
Yeah, you're getting that, and they're all different and they're all kind of usually
they
sort
kind
of going against the grain of the scene.
Well, but they kind of make a kind of they kind of almost make a score in a lot of scenes. Also, okay, there is one moment specifically where they use maybe fairly popular pop song.
And yeah, like pop with a capital P. Like it's like a girly like
bubblegum
song, and I don't know it. But I don't know. What did you think about that scene? Did you think that worked?
At first, I was like, what is this bullshit? Like, what in the hell is happening? But as it played out, like, honestly, by the time you saw where it was going and what it showed you, I was like, oh, interesting. Okay. No, that does make sense. Honestly, this film, I just would have to see again to almost get a reference on it completely.
To have an opinion?
Well, to have a real official opinion on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give you kind of like, okay, you'll like it if you like this kind of stuff. You'll definitely like it if you like experimental movies. If you want something experimental, but also crime and gritty, this is your jam almost.
Yeah.
Also, I for the most part, liked all the actors. I can't say anything bad. I thought that Guy Pearce was mostly frightening.
Yeah.
And you don't steal his car. You don't
fucking
steal his car.
You don't steal his car. Just don't.
It's not worth it, I promise. No, he's pretty good in the movie, and he plays stoic very well, and he has a really interesting presence. I feel like Robert Pattinson isn't up to this.
Really?
He's wearing, like, these weird redneck teeth. He's speaking in this kind of unspecific Southern accent, American Southern accent, and not doing it very well. He kind of sounds like he has peanut butter in his mouth the whole movie, and I feel like he's acting. He's really, like, he's desperate to say, I'm not Edward, and he's, like, trying really hard to be ugly, and actually, one of the lines in that pop song was, don't hate me because I'm beautiful, and I said, and it's a scene that highlights Pattinson specifically, and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe this is a self-reflective moment here. I'm not, like, totally, like, against Pattinson as an actor.
Maybe the director chose that too specifically because he already had that scene in mind, and so he was like, I want somebody of that ilk, and he wants a certain kind of reference from it. But honestly, I disagree with you. I thought he was pretty good, pretty decent in it, and I didn't need that full, like, oh, I'm Aussie kind of accent. Like, that's not the kind of movie. I mean, you're definitely using that as the backdrop, but this film is so elemental and so just so crime genre, but in a weird, again, surrealistic, weird way. To me, that was my only interpretation, because it definitely was not playing into that typical quiet crime kind of thing that was normally going on.
Well, I mean, if we don't really want to get into it, I think Guy Pearce here, his character is almost, it's almost kind of a samurai thing going on. It's almost a Yojimbo-esque character, or you know, the lone, or like Melville's La Samurai.
Okay.
That kind of a character, even like George Clooney in The American, like that kind of, or even like Ryan Gosling in Drive. One of those kind of existential man with no name, man a few words kind of character. And I think he pulls that off great. The Robert Pattinson thing, I get they're going for elemental, they're painting in broad brush strokes. I'm fine with all of that. My issue is I just feel like he's trying. I see his actor tics all over this movie, and it kind of takes me out.
I disagree. I was fine with him. I didn't. That of anything didn't really hinder me. I mean, the only thing that I really like, maybe kind of like, there wasn't a clear thing, but this was definitely very experimental. So I have a hard time saying exactly with the act in reference to the acting. I have an easy time saying I didn't really have a problem with anybody, including Pattinson. I thought Pattinson was fine. In fact, I thought he did a fairly good job. I think the acting tics and all that, didn't see it. I thought it was fine. I thought he played a slow person very well. I'm not saying that's his typical. I'm just saying, oh, that was interesting.
You were pulled in.
I was along for the ride, because from almost the get-go, you're almost kind of like in a strange headspace. It's definitely dream logic, and you're not in your regular place. And so,
do you think that going back to the milieu, do you think that this is a post-apocalyptic story? Because they pass what looks to be like people crucified on the side of the road.
You know,
they also, like, there's this whole, like, every time they go to a store, it's not like a normal store. They're like, it's a weird, like, pawn shop bartering system where they're like shoving money through little slots to get their items.
Well,
and then there's all these references to, like, I can't believe you care about your car in this day and age. And at the beginning, it says 12 years after the decline or something like 10 that.
10 years after the global economic collapse.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that means the future or the past. I don't think that that's really important to this film.
No, but it's saying.
But
I
do think
there.
What I'm saying is I think they're playing on that milieu. Sure, they're playing on the post-apocalypse, whatever kind of attitude,
Mad Max-y,
whatever thing of Australia. But do I think that they're going for the full out? No, I think this is complete dream. I did not get.
So for all we know, it's not even planet Earth.
No, this could be Australia on planet X.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think it's interested in any of that. I think it's interested in the elements and what's happening. And I honestly would have to, I'd have to look at it again to really comment on what was completely going on in a lot.
Yeah, I mean, story-wise, it's very simple.
Yes.
There's very, I mean, as far as what it's going on, and it's, what's really cool about it is kind of like Under the Skin that we were talking about, it's giving you nothing as far as what's going to happen.
Yeah.
The thing just unfolds on you and you just have to stay with it and see where it goes. And it, you know, it's constantly opening interesting doors.
I think we're actually coming up on probably on a group of filmmakers.
This Australian team in general, yeah. David Michaud, the Edgertons.
Yeah.
And what's his face? Who did, those movies with, Nick Cave.
Oh, John
Hillcoat.
John Hillcoat. Shit,
John Hillcoat. And yeah, all these guys are, Australia is a really interesting place right now.
Oh yeah. I mean,
especially for the crime genre.
For the crime genre. And I mean, we just watched that film, Wake and Fright a little bit ago. And I found that immensely interesting film.
And definitely this era seems to be really referring to that.
Well, what I was going to say, besides it being an interesting time period in Australia, was I think we are coming up on a group of filmmakers, like just a generation of filmmakers that saw Mulholland Drive and went back and visited Blue Velvet and visited these kind of films. And now they have to make their surrealistic Blue Velvets and their surrealistic... I'm not saying this film is that much like that. They're definitely taking Australia and making that their own weird dreamscape, which kind of is. In a lot of ways, to anybody who's not from there. I mean, it further emphasizes that you should not ever live in the Australian outback, basically Sydney, and that's the only place.
Yeah.
I mean,
Most of Australia, if you go according to film, is uninhabitable and dangerous.
And scary.
And scary.
Well, they also have that whole, like, weird, like, it's like this, I don't know what act, because I don't think you can really... You can break them up into scenes, not really acts.
Yeah.
And the whole weird scene with the carnival gypsy town.
Oh, yeah, and, like, the prostitution ring. And there's all this, like, influx of Asian culture in this. That's why I said there's something almost post-apocalyptic about this. It feels almost like post-government.
Well, if it is, it's... I almost read it as like, oh, so at one point in Australia's history when... are they speaking about kind of a time period, but they're just speaking about it in kind of like weird, surrealistic kind of dream logic space? Like, are they speaking about a violent era then?
It's worth taking a look at, I think, at the very least. I'm not 100% sure if it's a good movie. I enjoyed most of it.
Are you not 100% sure if it's a bad movie?
Yeah.
I know, that's where I'm at. I don't know what to tell you, and all I know to tell you is if you're into experimental film, you're into taking a chance, and you're into the gritty violence, like crime, you need
it's
all...
It's super violent, yeah, and it's an interesting ride, and it's kind of even sort of fun to go along with the ride. I'm not sure how much the movie says about anything.
Yeah.
There's a lot of aesthetics going on. It might be all that's there. I wasn't into Pattinson as much as you were, but I thought that as a weird experience of a film, it's worth looking at.
Oh, hell yeah.
I would say Animal Kingdom is a great deal better than this movie, though.
I haven't seen Animal Kingdom. Is it like that?
It has kind of an eeriness to it as well, and it's kind of a slow burn, but it's a lot more of kind of a family drama.
That's what I was going to ask. Film. Is it have this strange dream logic? Not
as much. No.
I kind of assumed because I saw enough about Animal Kingdom to kind of get what it was.
Yeah.
And this did not seem like that. And so as soon as I was in the headspace, I was like, oh, this is different.
Animal Kingdom I just kind of went on the ride. Animal Kingdom was kind of like the Australian Winter's Bone.
Yeah.
I would say that's kind of a closer
comparison. And that's what I was talking about, the quiet Winter's Bone is kind of the typical like crime kind of element genre thing we're seeing right now through crime.
Yeah.
And this was, I don't think
this is a little bit more like, what was that movie by Nicholas Winding Refn that just came out? Only God Forgives.
I would say a great deal better, but, sort of, I would say that, Only God Forgives is very much his Kung Fu David Lynch film, but
yeah.
again, I do think there are several directors that are coming out right now that were young and saw his films and were like, oh, I want to make a film kind of like that. It was weird and cool and I want to do that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's their entry on this. Now, am I going to say the first time was interesting? Yes. Well, do I want to go back to it? Yeah. So I would recommend it to people who are in for that kind of experience, because it's definitely not...
You just have to kind of ride with it.
It's not... Yeah. It's not... There's at no point is it... I mean, the samurai film is a good reference, but there's never going to be a dude that, like, you know, punches another dude through the moon or anything, but...
Yeah.
And it doesn't have a typical plot structure at all.
Yeah.
You are along for the ride.
Okay, well, that's going to do us for this episode, and like I said, there's not going to be a Netflix homework this week, but we are going to be talking about Basquiat, next week, when I get back home and have a chance to watch it. And I don't have all my stuff to read, so go to facebook.com/jabberpodcast, like us there, you'll see when we post episodes and news items. Email us if you want to about anything we talked about or about our commentary track or whatever at jabberinthedrone.gmail.com. We're on Stitcher. We're on iTunes.
Yeah, just try to find us at any of those places. And if you can't find it at your favorite location, let us know.
Alrighty. Okay. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.